In March of 2024, the Infographics Show, a popular and excellent channel with custom animations and fantastic storytelling, posted a video titled U.S. Special Forces Confession, I Recovered Crashed UFOs. Although the channel has covered the UAP subject in the past, this entry stood out entirely. The video covers the testimony of an individual who encountered a crashed UAP while serving in Vietnam. With engaging storytelling and mesmerizing animations, the infographics team highlights how this sighting saw the soldier read into covert UAP operations and details his work on the program. Astonishing details of UAP crash retrieval and reverse engineering are highlighted in this account, very similar to the claims of David Grush. I'm sure many people saw this video, enjoyed it, and moved on, just as many watched it and thought, huh, I wonder if this is real. But the narrator starts this video with a statement that almost forces us to analyze the entire video line by line.
Note, the following is based on testimony provided over a series of interviews and written correspondence, edited and cut together in an attempt to create a cohesive timeline of the events as described.
Do these events recount the experience of a real anonymous whistleblower? Is this story rooted in fact, and are there elements we can verify? And why did he speak to the infographics show? Hey guys, it's UAP Gerb, and thank you for joining me as we conduct a full breakdown and analysis of the infographics show's U.S. Special Forces Confession, I Recovered UFOs. Since its release, I have played this testimony over and over and over in my head. Is it possible that these events and details recount the true testimony of someone on a UFO crash retrieval program? I think it is well worth investigating their story, searching for holes or confirmable elements, because this could very well be the most crucial first-hand whistleblower of all time. To start, our witness states, and I will be calling him our witness for the duration of this video, that our story begins in 1968 during the Vietnam conflict along the Vietnam-Cambodia border. Before we get into his story, we do have two interesting Vietnam cases that may be contextually relevant to our infographics whistleblower. We can check in on the ever-relevant Stephen Greer redacted witness log to analyze the statements and emails of witness 10622. 10622 served as CTR Communication Technician Radio in the U.S. Navy from 1966 to 1970 on the Bonhomme Richard aircraft carrier. It was in June of 1968 on official duties, he received scrambled messages mentioning at least 11 UAP were tracked on visual and radar. And on September 9th, 1968, several US helicopter pilots and soldiers stationed at a Marine Corps base in Dong Ha, Vietnam, had a close encounter with a fast-moving object. This object had green and white lights and engaged in maneuvers for 20 minutes. Anyways, our witness states his U.S. military unit was performing an LRRP, a long-range reconnaissance patrol tracking supply routes into South Vietnam from Cambodia, as well as marking out sites for a B-52 bombing raid the following year. This tiny snippet in the video gives us so much to unpack. The following year of 1969, a covert bombing raid did in fact occur. On March 18, 1969, the Strategic Air Command commenced Operation Menu. Not declassified until 2000 by President Bill Clinton, Operation Menu was a year-long B-52 bombing campaign that ravaged eastern Cambodia, and that mention, LRRP, may be one of the most significant pieces to solving this puzzle. Long-range reconnaissance patrol was a special unit acting in Vietnam, Company E 52nd Infantry, attached to the 1st Cavalry Division in the U.S. Army. This unit operated in Vietnam from 1967 to 1969, well within the time frame of our witness, and participated in two of the largest battles of Vietnam, the Tet Offensive and Siege of Khe Sanh. In late October of 1968, Company E 52nd Infantry was relocated and headquartered at Phuoc Vinh, north of Vietnam. The division's area of operations was designated along the Cambodian border in Thay Ninh, Binh Long, and Phuoc Long provinces, all in South Vietnam, quote, "These areas contain significant routes for enemy infiltration into the Saigon area from Cambodia." So if our witness is telling the truth and this crash is real, this event occurred in October to December 1968 within the Company E 52nd Infantry LRRP stationed out of Phuoc Vinh. So far, his testimony lines up exactly with real events. And finally, back to our story. A quote-unquote object appeared overhead the witness and his platoon, emitting a bright red-orange glow appearing to be melting. The object quickly moved out of sight, but only 5 or 6 seconds later, a large crash followed by a dull thump reverberated throughout the jungle. The platoon figured this must have been a U.S. plane, so knowing better than to risk long-range radio communications being intercepted by Soviet agents, they moved to secure the crash site. Arriving at the site, the platoon knew immediately this was not a U.S. plane classified or acknowledged. The only prosaic explanation the soldiers could think of was a crashed space probe, something from NASA or the Soviets. The craft was egg-shaped, dull gray and metallic, and seemingly cracked open. Again, we see the description this craft appeared to be made from a single piece of metal with no bolts, seams, or screws. This sighting and craft description give us a lot to work off of, actually. What immediately stands out to me is this red-orange glow the craft emanated while flying over the jungle. There are two cases within our crash's time frame that are worth mentioning that are similar to this. We can look to November 22nd of 1968 to NICAP case 681122. On this date in Albany, Georgia, a glowing yellow-white oval UFO was seen from a car, directed a light beam at the vehicle, and flew away changing colors to red and orange. And let's head to Mouv, France on December 15th, 1968, reported in a book translated as UFO, the first complete file on close encounters in France. We can find a case where an egg-shaped object the size of a car moved quickly without making noise, emanating orange reflections. But let's not forget an event that occurred just a year earlier on March 24th, 1967, highlighted in the sworn affidavits by Captain Robert Salas and others at Malmstrom Air Force Base. I covered this case in my UFO and nukes video, but this event saw a red-orange oval UAP appear over the base, disabling the ICBMs of Malmstrom. And this mention of an egg-shaped object comes up again and again and again in ufology. We will talk about this more later in the video with the witnesses' experience within the program, but let's look at the testimony of aerospace contractor Eric Tabor to Aero, who recounted an egg-shaped metallic UFO being kept at Area 51 in the 1980s. The description of this craft is almost identical to the Vietnam encounter. And lastly, the molten feel of the craft reminds me closely of the mother of pearl effect displayed on the skin of the craft Lance Corporal Jonathan Weygandt claimed to have observed in the jungles of Peru in 1997. Our platoon of Marines called in the crash only to hear there were already birds en route and ordered to secure the crash. Quickly, a pair of F-4 jets fell into orbit overhead. The mention of the McDonnell Douglas F-4 Phantom II may seem small, but this is actually a huge detail in our story. In June of 1986, former Bechtel Corps contractor James McCampbell told ufologist Jacques Vallée he met with a military contact with the Wild Weasels, a codename given by USAF for aircraft equipped with anti-radiation missiles and tasked with the suppression of enemy air defenses in Vietnam. This contractor told McCampbell F-4 jets were equipped with EM detection equipment to detect UAP during the war. Dr. Stephen Greer may have an additional witness adding valuable context to these F-4 claims. Witness 10272 claims to have worked for a UK-based contractor installing low observable radar assemblies on F-4 fighters at Area 51. Along with these claims, the witness alleges to have been involved in the evaluation of hardware from NHI craft. Anyways, infantry then touched down and acted in perimeter security, but I want to note the witness states they were allowed nowhere near the craft. They were deployed in a wide swath. It took 2 days for the craft to be removed from the jungle, all with the help of SOF, Special Operations Forces, Navy, and Air Force officials on site who had already been read into the program. The mention of the Air Force is no surprise here. Ever since the 1947 Roswell, New Mexico crash and the involvement of USAF General Roger Ramey, the Air Force has long been entwined with the study of UAP. Again, I would like to recommend my Moondust video and USAF document AFC-1E draft policy, which states Project UFO and Moondust, both headquartered out of the Air Force, have collection responsibilities for UAP and descended foreign space vehicles. The Navy is a bit more interesting. Sure, we have Rear Admiral Timothy Gallaudet, who speaks openly about UAP and OPNAV regulations to restrict UAP reporting I covered in my USO videos, but I can't help thinking about the Wilson-Davis memo. After all, if this memo is true, which I fully believe it is, DIA Director and Vice Admiral Thomas Wilson was stonewalled from reading into the program. This was our witness's first ever interaction with the program. Throughout Vietnam, several rapid reaction units were on standby for retrieval purposes. And it's here the witness adds some interesting context.
That's what everyone called it, the program. And there were several rapid reaction units stationed throughout in theater. See, we learned from the Korean War that these things are attracted to conflict, and I guess that it makes sense. It's probably one of the most interesting things we do. A lot of people think this whole mess started in World War II, and maybe it did, but the program got put together during the Korean War, and that's when it was official.
The Korean War lasted from 1950 to 1953. While the first U.S.-based retrieval of a UAP occurred in Roswell in 1947, it is possible the program took a few years to put together. If we are going to believe the MJ-12 documents, the program in charge of UAP investigation, crash retrieval, and reverse engineering operated under U.S. President Truman and briefed President Eisenhower, who took office in 53. This means the program was put together during 1945, more like 1947 to 1950, fitting in nicely with the realm of the Korean War. We can, of course, guess the program was already implemented by 1950 when senior radio engineer wrote to the Canadian Controller of Telecommunications in the Department of Transport, stating the U.S. was actively engaged in studying UAP in an effort so classified it rated even higher than the H-bomb. This information was provided to the engineer Wilbert B. Smith by physicist and member of the U.S. Research and Development Board and student under Einstein, Robert Sarbacher. I highly recommend my video on this subject as it very well may cover the early days of the program. The witness also states, quote, "These things are attracted to conflict," end quote. Well, we know from numerous stories, including Robert Salas and Malmstrom Air Force Base, UAP have a direct interest in observing and interacting with nuclear arms. We know from the testimony of Bob Jacobs, UAP have even an interest in dummy flights of ICBMs. And if the 1953 Kingman, Arizona crash is true, let's remember this happening during Operation Upshot Knothole, which oversaw extensive nuclear testing.
It certainly looks like they want to understand how far we've advanced in our nuclear fissile kind of technologies at the very least. I mean, it looks like preparatory probing activity. It might be innocent kind of scientific gathering, could be ISR probing.
Anyways, it was at this time the witness and his fellow platoon mates were read into the program. Joining the program was by force. The soldiers were faced with this or a general discharge, likely drug charges or an Article 15, which gives military commanders an easy way to punish minor infractions breaching military conduct. This draws my attention to an alleged crash retrieval that occurred on April 12, 1954, relayed to Leonard Stringfield by a witness K.A. You can read about this in Stringfield's UFO Crash Retrieval Status Report 3, Amassing the Evidence, and the link, of course, will be in the description. In this incident, K.A. and a USAF crew Rescue 4 out of Roswell Air Force Base were dispatched to a site 25 to 30 miles northwest, where they observed a metallic saucer crashed edgewise into the sand with a dome in its center. A ground crew in fatigues was already at this site, prevented the men from getting closer, and began tagging debris and scattered NHI bodies. K.A. returned to Roswell, was debriefed for 3 days in a quote-unquote living hell, and told by men identifying as intelligence officers in civilian clothes not to speak about the incident, reading to K.A. a law that referred to a fine, imprisonment with hard labor, and general discharge. Our witness states his introduction to the program was highly compartmentalized. He was only told what he needed to know. This mirrors accurately the compartmentalization discussed in the Wilson-Davis memo. The four programs that referred Admiral Wilson to the program were, quote, part of it, in different compartments, placed in different layers of the compartment's pyramid, split up to do different things of parts of it. It is interesting to hear our witness state,
"I didn't even realize those damn things were from space until I actually saw a body."
So some of these craft are indeed from space and some are manned vessels. We know from my Fastwalker video, there is factual evidence USG elements had a term for objects entering or leaving Earth's atmosphere, denoted as Fastwalkers. And defense support satellites were likely used to monitor these objects. And the subject of bodies can be pretty contentious, but like David Grush said,
"Well, naturally, when you recover something that's either landed or crashed, sometimes you encounter dead pilots. And believe it or not, as fantastical as that sounds, it's true.
The witness states the more he figured out, the more he was read into the program. He never learned all the truth, but knew enough he felt compelled to come forward, especially as an aging gentleman. Serving in Vietnam, I would put this individual's age at around 74 or older. And claiming he had been out of the program for 20 years means his service in the program occurred from around 1969 to 2004. The witness even discusses David Grush, commenting on his approach to speaking publicly and labeling him a patriot. He even confirms the involvement of aerospace contractors and sophisticated disinformation. I don't think we need to expand on these topics too much in general, as I have multiple videos exploring the full involvement of Lockheed Martin and Battelle Memorial Institute's interaction with UAP and fully covered the birth of the UAP stigma. Check out those videos for some valuable context here. After being read into the program, the witnesses unit was put back on duty but broken up and placed in horrific combat engagements. 5 of the original 12 died in combat.
I know 5 of the original 12 died in combat. 3 more badly wounded. I think they were trying to kill us off.
If this broken up team still served with the 1st Cavalry Division LRRP, we may in fact be able to track these names. Of the 1,000 men who served in this unit, 45 were killed in Vietnam and Cambodia. And the witness states a year after the initial crash, he was officially brought into the program where his primary job was no longer being a soldier, but he was now part of the program. So with this information, we can conclude that these soldiers were killed between October to December of 1968, where the crash occurred, and October to December of 1969, when he was brought into the program. And we'll give an error factor of around plus or minus, let's say, 3 months. I have actually found a memorial site dedicated to those served and fell in the LRRP unit within the 1st Cavalry Division. Analyzing the casualty list, we can try and trace the deaths of these brave soldiers from the time of our crash, October to December 68, and our witness being read into the program October to December 1969. So we're left with 16 possible names. If we filter out soldiers who died of non-hostile actions, we are left with 8 possible names. If our witness is telling the truth, 5 of 8 of these names are likely platoon mates of his who observed the crashed, egg-shaped UAP.
It didn't happen often, but these things did fall out of the sky, or people would see something land or witness beings happening more often than people know, and we'd swoop in as fast as we could in case there was anything to snatch up. I think we pulled 3 total craft out of theater, and not just Vietnam. Damn near started a war with China in one recovery.
Up to 3 craft in Vietnam? Well, perhaps there are others who can expand on this. Within Stephen Greer's redacted witness list we return to again and again and again, we find witness 10659, quote, "firsthand involvement in Vietnam crash/retrieval of ET craft. Involved directly with ET technology, POC to other military UFO events, including dad's presence at 1954 Edwards Air Force Base UFO landing." I do think this witness is separate from our infographics witness due to the claims of dad's presence at a 1954 Edwards AFB landing. The witness comments how one retrieval almost started a war with China, the program only getting the upper hand due to China's primitive early warning systems. David Grush has commented on this, a multi-decade-long Cold War between the U.S., China, and other U.S. adversaries.
We're in a competition with their adversaries to understand this, and it's a multi-decade Cold War that has been under our nose for so long, and you know, there is no good way to level the playing field and hold other nation states accountable if they're doing unethical or illicit activity as it relates to the subject. And I think the obtuse secrecy is actually putting us in a very dangerous position where a country might make a breakthrough, let's say it's an adversary of ours, and it is so destabilizing.
You say there's been a Cold War behind the scenes with Russia and China.
There has been a Cold War against with our peer adversaries, yeah.
The witness also states recoveries in the ocean would be near impossible, that Europe was another hotspot for UFO activity. This was due to curiosity towards the always militarized European mainland, especially within the Cold War and a few decades removed from World War II. Europe was able to keep a tighter lid on the subject, especially with the European populace, quote, "turning their nose up at the whole UFO thing," end quote.
The crafts themselves were extraordinary. That's the only way to describe them. I wasn't there for every single recovery, obviously, but they kept collections of them in different places, and I got to see two of the collections.
The question of craft housing and material handling is done is always fascinating, starting with a quote-unquote collection of craft. As we know from David Grush, the USG is in possession of up to 12 to 15 craft.
When you say crash retrieval, what do you mean?
These are retrieving non-human origin technical vehicles, you know, call it spacecraft if you will, non-human, exotic origin vehicles that have either landed or crashed.
We have spacecraft from another species.
We do, yeah.
How many?
Quite a number.
You're kidding.
No.
These claims have been echoed by numerous whistleblowers, including alleged S4 Project Aquarius biologist Dan Barish. Sit tight for a video on him, but he claimed 9 hangar bays housed UAP and reverse-engineered vehicles, including the 1953 Kingman, Arizona crash at S4. The witness states Wright-Patterson and the Foreign Technology Division is a red herring, that this is where the Soviets would have immediately come looking, quote, "We faked some stuff going into Wright-Patterson," end quote. It's likely in the early days of the program, Wright-Pat housed both crashes and biological material, and we only have to look at Roswell to guess that. This means that either before or during the witness's tenure in the program, program duties shifted away from the airbase, and any sort of material or crash sighting at Wright-Pat from roughly 1969 to 2004 are hoaxes perpetrated by the program. Now, there is some conflicting information here, as I think back to the testimony of Senator Barry Goldwater, who in 1975 was stonewalled by General Curtis LeMay into accessing the Blue Room at Wright-Pat where UAP information and materials were likely stored. Possibly this means Wright-Pat held a database or record of UAP and program activity, but not actual materials and biologics.
There were these co-op sites run by the government and the big defense contractors, people like Raytheon, Boeing. Everyone knows their names, but also people like Texas Instruments. It was a whole umbrella, but the little guys only got a tiny piece of the puzzle. Some guys from TI would get a piece of something and then be asked to figure out how it works, never being told where it came from. And on its own, I'm sure these eggheads had their suspicions, but it's hard to tell if something's actually alien.
Raytheon, Boeing, and Texas Instruments are specifically name-dropped. And we can infer T.I. is one of the quote-unquote little guys mentioned here, as the witness proposes the example of T.I. getting a little piece of something. Can we find one interesting connection for each of these three companies? Well, to start, we can find Raytheon name drop specifically alongside Lockheed Martin, Aerospace Corp, TRW, etc. by Lockheed Martin astrophysicist Bernard Haish, as one of a major aerospace company in which the legacy UAP programs hide. In 1956, Boeing was mentioned in a special weapons study of aviation studies examination of electrogravitic systems. This piece references a Project Winterhaven, which suggests construction of a saucer, creating a local gravitational field designated to serve as a USAF interceptor. Boeing was one such company mentioned on working on these anti-gravity rigs. When we hear Texas Instruments, we think of the TI-84 calculator that got me through college, at least I do. But TI also operates within the aerospace and defense industries. Unfortunately, there is not much to confirm here, as the only link to TI I can find is a 1961 establishment of the Southwest Center for Advanced Studies by TI to work on gravitational physics. And finally, onto everybody's favorite subject, the craft. The witness makes a very curious claim. Although he knows these craft can operate in a microgravity medium, he does not know if they are really spacecraft, and wonders if, quote, "that's where they want us to think they are coming from," end quote. The witness comments ufology has done a pretty good job at compiling craft shape.
So you got your flying eggs, your Tic Tacs, I guess you now call them. We just call them pills. Your old-fashioned saucers, bells, triangles, whole mess of shapes. But the ones that crash are almost always the eggs and the bells.
In AERO's data from 1996 to 2023, we can actually find the most commonly reported UAP configurations. Factoring out spheres and lights, which in my opinion often have a more possible prosaic explanation than other configurations, we can see commonly cited craft shapes accurately reflect our witnesses list. Eggs and bell shapes are the most frequently crashed objects, according to our witness, sometimes disintegrating on impact, and our witness claims these are likely unmanned drones. We have already covered some really interesting and possibly credible eggs and oval-shaped objects, Eric Tabor and Jonathan Weygand. But what about this bell? There is a fascinating and perplexing case that occurred in 1965 in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, I plan to cover soon. Allegedly, a bell-shaped, almost acorn object crashed in the area. This case was covered extensively by Leonard Stringfield, so if you'd like to brush up before my video, I recommend reading his UFO Crash Retrievals, The Inner Sanctum, Status Report 6. And if you remember from my Robert Sarbacher video, Dr. Eric Walker, an alleged original program manager, claimed to have been on site and at location for this crashed object. Our witness declares the saucers are the crown jewels, and he only ever participated in the recovery of two such craft. I probably don't need to dive too much into the importance of discs or saucers in UFO lore, but let's see if we can investigate the witness's aid in a crash retrieval in South America.
The saucer we recovered had hit the side of a rocky outcropping on its way down. It smashed the rock to pieces, then took out a quarter mile of trees. If it had happened on the outskirts of civilization, the whole UFO mystery would have been public knowledge by now. That's how much destruction that thing caused. But the craft itself was relatively unharmed.
I will be using the date frame 1969 to 2004 I derived earlier for our witnesses' time in the program. I can find three relevant cases for my all-time favorite crash retrieval handbook, Magic Eyes Only by Ryan S. Wood. We will not be covering the 1997 Jonathan Weygand Peru case or the 1978 Moondust retrieval in Bolivia, as these craft are explicitly stated as not saucer-like. One example can be found that was also relayed in the notes of Leonard Stringfield, dated March 23, 1978. In his notes, Stringfield spoke with one Bob Berry, who claimed a UFO crash retrieval occurred on November 11, 1975, very close to Lima, Peru. This craft was unmanned and measured 12 feet high and 8 feet in diameter. If what our witness is saying is true, and mostly egg/bells are unmanned, this may not be a saucer, but still worth mentioning. The outer surface was metallic with material deemed to be non-terrestrial. Another possible event occurred in Potrerillos, Chile, 1978. Pulled from the files of Bob Pratt also, he learned while in the area a year later, a tremendous explosion occurred that woke up all 3,000 people in the area. All houses shook and everyone thought a blast furnace had exploded. Engineers determined the event was an airburst. The explosion occurred in the air and the blast force exerted downwards. Following the crash, American operatives in NASA coveralls arrived at the scene questioning witnesses. An American or Soviet spacecraft, maybe, but when Bob Pratt filed FOIA requests to NASA and the CIA, they responded they had no data on the event. And we can find a third case that's also mentioned in Stringfield's UFO Crash Retrieval Syndrome Status Report, Two New Sources, New Data, which discusses an October 3rd, 1980 saucer crash in Piedra de la Guia, Argentina. Here, witnesses in a 300-mile radius saw what appeared to be a saucer-shaped fireball come down from the skies and explode near 7 p.m. Some witnesses claim the fireball flew in circles before crashing, exhibiting intelligent control. Captain Carlos Lima, then head of the Space Research Division of the Argentinian Air Force, officially investigated the incident. He found four burned spots circular and 10 to 18 meters in diameter, and noticed what appeared, quote, to be the product of combustion originated by liquid fuel or some sort of material with a very high temperature, end quote. Could any of these cases, or possibly the Varginha, Brazil case so excellently covered by James Fox, be the crash our witness mentioned? When the witness reached the administrative side of the program, he learned saucers were formed from a single piece of material or put together at an atomic level, quote, even the entrance is invisible until it actually opens, end quote, but interiors could be accessed through destructive and non-destructive means. I have recently covered two witnesses whose claims mirror these statements identically. MS, who declared the UFO he observed undergoing inspections at Dugway Proving Ground was, quote, flawless, like it had been 3D printed, and RB, who claimed the saucer he guarded in 1963 had a door panel with tolerances so tight not even a piece of paper could fit through the seams. The first mention of biologics comes with the South American saucer retrieval. Once access was gained to the craft, the interior reeked of decaying organic material. The quote-unquote things inside were dead.
I call them things on purpose. Not out of disrespect or anything like that, I just don't think any of us were ever convinced they were actually living creatures. Well, not in the sense that you and I are.
These biologics featured a crude digestive system, only enough to process basic proteins and such, leading the witness and program to believe these things were similar to biological androids. The typical gray alien depicted in media is allegedly accurate, but these beings are a little taller than the famous humanoids and possess large but not massive eyes. The witness remarks how these beings were raised in a dimly lit environment supported by their dimly lit craft. These creatures featured long limbs and knees, quote, not in the right places, end quote. The subject of almost android-like living beings has been echoed by many, including Dr. Gary Nolan.
I think that part of what we're seeing here, I mean, look, if you're an intelligence, are you going to go down on a planet with a bunch of angry monkeys who might kill you? No, unlikely. You'll send some intermediary. Well, what kind of intermediary are you going to send? You're going to send something that maybe almost looks like them, but isn't them. So I think, and this is, again, from inside the intelligence community, most of what we think we're seeing are avatars, biological robots that are basically put there to be the minions, if you will.
And that's the current view of the intel community.
It is a hypothesis.
Living biologics had been recovered by our witness, specifically at a near UK-based retrieval. This event occurred at the same time of a meteor strike in the UK area. And I actually think I may have found this incident. This story occurred in May of 1996 in Boyle, Ireland. Locals witnessed a meteor or an aerial craft heading towards land, appearing to misjudge its approach, shearing trees and landing in a lake. Allegedly, several occupants were taken into custody by a retrieval team, and significant military activity, including American soldiers, continued for the following 6 months. Even local police were instructed to stay away. The American soldier bit here is key, as our witness states Europe has a default agreement with the United States that recovered materials go to the U.S., but quote, "That's the price you pay for having a superpower watch your back." At this crash site, the witness states 2 of 5 of the craft's crew survived. Light bruising covered the dead from the hard landing. The program has ruthlessly strict protocols for dealing with live biologics, according to our witness. These rules include never leveling a weapon at a being, and for that matter, security is positioned well away and out of sight from the biologics, immediately taking readings to ensure nothing toxic or hazardous is present near the craft. And medical personnel are then sent to the craft area or interior, including a lead doctor known as the Ambassador, who always spoke at least English, Chinese, Spanish, and Russian. The biologics at this UK crash just stood around aimlessly, solely reacting to basic stimuli as the team entered the craft after the door opened on its own. The beings were even let out of the craft like school children. In this instance, and almost any other where live biologics were recovered, the witness remarks the beings live at most a few days before they keel over dead. These points, alongside the fact that beings could breathe Earth's atmosphere, are used by the witness to support the hypothesis they are like drones or biological computers, like Gary Nolan said.
Whatever's making these things just creates a biological crew when it needs one, and they do their job and nothing else. At least that was our theory. Because their bodies didn't seem built to last, and the eggheads found it suspicious that they were able to breathe our atmosphere so easily.
Of course, we do not have access to any living or deceased NHI biologics in the public sector, so are there at least any parallels we can draw from the witness? The subject of biologics and their taxonomy is one of the most contentious subjects in UAP. The visual of the classic gray alien, small beings varying in color with elongated limbs, frail bodies, enlarged heads, large to enormous eyes, tiny to non-existent noses and mouths have been echoed since the dawn of UAP lore. From Roswell to Kingman to abductee claims to myriad files in the Leonard Stringfield files, similar descriptions of non-human biologics pop up everywhere. And this isn't mentioning countless accusations of the program being in possession of living and dead beings. Unfortunately, this is also one of the most lied about and hoaxed aspects of the phenomenon. So, for now, we must stick to the direct confirmation of biological retrieval confirmed by Grush.
sometimes you encounter dead pilots.
And relayed statements of, quote, little gray men whose ships had crashed or had been shot down, being kept on ice by the Air Force Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, end quote. As stated by former Special Assistant to the Deputy Director of the CIA, Victor Marchetti. Our witness goes back to pondering why it is saucers and maybe one or two other types actually have a manned crew. I'm guessing maybe one of these is the triangular shape. The witness in the program had a theory, quote, this was all being fabricated for us, and even tasked NASA
to look for where something like a big 3D printer could be in the solar system. Some facility or computer just making these crafts and these things and sending them to Earth. And sometimes they crashed or they just landed and didn't take off. Like, whatever was doing this wanted us to recover the craft. I don't know if they ever found anything, though there was some excitement for a while. It's hard to hide heat in space, and obviously making these crafts on such a large scale would give off a lot of heat. Or maybe not. Maybe they use physics we don't even understand.
These are some very charged statements with a lot to unpack. We do know around the time of our witness's involvement in the program, NASA openly denied studying UFOs. However, we can find a letter to NASA Chief of Ground Operations Safety, dated December 13, 1977. This page, observed only via FOIA request, is directed towards the NASA Administrator about UFOs, detailing, quote, what could be a piece of a UFO, end quote, was examined at Los Alamos for a period of over 2 months. Additionally, on page 121 and 126 of this Black Vault PDF detailing NASA FOIA requests, we can see an internal memo admit the agency conducted a UFO hard evidence analysis program titled UFO HEAP around the late 70s. And this 3D printer has actually a very real basis in 20th century physics. The idea of a universal constructor or self-replicating automata was first proposed in the 1940s by physicist John von Neumann, who, by the way, was listed as being involved in UFO recovery along with Vannevar Bush and Robert Oppenheimer by physicist Robert Sarbacher I talked about earlier. His theory explores how a sub-faster-than-light civilization can colonize a galaxy. The automata involve robotic or nanorobotic systems that replicate by creating miniature copies of themselves which grow over time. Such a feat would require an abundance of materials, so maybe this heat signature the witness mentioned occurred near our asteroid belt. But the replicator hub nestled within the dark regions of a solar system for creating craft and, I guess, biologics is an extremely plausible scenario. This even rings identically to the alleged 4chan whistleblower, who stated a UFO replicator lies within our oceans. And these statements by our witness, quote, whatever was doing this wanted us to recover the craft, end quote, is widely known within ufology as donation craft. This subject has been touched on by David Grush.
Call it spacecraft, if you will. Non-human, exotic origin, vehicles that have either landed or crashed.
Is the subject of Eric Tabor's Arrow testimony, as this egg-shaped craft was simply found untouched in the desert and features in many corners of ufology. The witness makes multiple mentions to failed in 1990s successful attempts to down UAP craft. One failure occurred in Iran, and I am almost positive this is the 1976 Iran Major Jafari case. The successful downing of UAP craft is something I have covered often, including in my last video where witness TB states the USG developed technology within the Star Wars program to down craft. People have been hurt by these craft, according to the witness, but theorizes this is incidental and a byproduct of the craft themselves. Manned or unmanned, the craft have the ability to distort perception and mess with minds. Quote-unquote, anchors were formed for recovery operatives to keep them grounded in reality.
For instance, if you and I were on a security team and approached a craft, we'd say, okay, the craft is resting up against a big oak tree, and there's a gray boulder on the other side. You'd think of that picture, and it would help with the confusion whenever that effect happened, kind of ward it off.
This messing with human cognition has been mentioned extensively by Dr. Gary Nolan, and even mentioned in ATIP Slide 9, leaked from Christopher Mellon's personal website. And lastly, what do they want? The witness doesn't know. The program strongly supports the donation theory where the craft are gifted. Maybe the technology is gifted to not cause massive disruption within our own evolution.
We had another conclusion though, this one more disturbing. Maybe they just left these crafts lying around because they were easy to build.
Hey guys, thank you so much for watching as I broke down the infographics whistleblower who claimed to have first-hand experience in the crash retrieval program. My objective of this video was to analyze some of these claims, relate them to ufology at large, as well as try to investigate as much as we could about this whistleblower to see if their testimony and the individual is fact or fiction. So I think I feel pretty confident in us being able to kind of determine the time frame of this initial event in Vietnam occurring October to December 1968 in Company E 52nd Infantry in the 1st Cavalry Division LRRP, close to Saigon in South Vietnam, probably Phuoc Long. And I'm pretty confident in 5 of the 8 or 9 names, I may have messed that up, who following died in combat after the initial sighting of the UAP from our whistleblower. And I'm also pretty confident in his introduction to the program October to December 1969 and his years of service 1969 to 2004. I'm also medium confident on the 3 South America crashes and Ireland UK crash that occurred in 1996. These are all not very known cases, pretty kind of low key, but you know, these kind of fit our timetable, fit our interest, fit what we were looking for. So guys, I do have a theory on who this whistleblower might be. Now this could very well be false. I don't think it holds much water, more so than dates and kind of interesting coincidences lining up, because if I had to put money on it, I do think this whistleblower is offering some true testimony here. I don't think this is as simple as just something fictitious. This is a very interesting testimony and a lot of things that line up to ufology at large. But the theory, remember, just a theory. For those of you who watched my last video, The Witness TB, do you remember the general that he said showed classified UAP-derived cloaking technology in 2004 and was thus investigated, demoted a star, and retired? This is General John M. Riggs. Guys, I think it's possible that this whistleblower is this aforementioned general, General John M. Riggs. Why do I think that? Well, John M. Riggs enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1965, was commissioned a second lieutenant in 1969, and he then went on to achieve 1,100 hours of flight time, earning himself a Distinguished Cross. Remember what he said in theater in Vietnam, a rapid reaction unit. This would make sense that if he then got his flying license in the military, helicopter pilot, he would have then served on that rapid reaction unit, possibly providing perimeter security and flying the team there, right? So his time in the military was 1965 when he enlisted, 1969 when he was commissioned an officer, to 2004. John M. Riggs was forced to retire in 2004-2005. So this lines up exactly with our witness's tenure in the program as well. And our witness states eventually he moved over to the administrative side of the program, right? Well, John M. Riggs was promoted to general and higher up in the military, worked with Congress. He was also stationed at a U.S. Army base in Germany. I'm not quite sure when this is, but this would line up with our UK-based crash, would it not? Kind of as our witness says, that Europe is always ready in a constant state of war, that, you know, these objects are attracted to conflict there. Again, this theory doesn't hold much water, but we know that if this story about John M. Riggs is true, which I do believe it is, because I do, with the credibility of TB's claims, Mr. Riggs is also well aware of UAP-derived tech, reverse engineering, and crash retrieval efforts. And let's not forget, once he retired after allegedly showing a BAE Systems employee classified technology, he went on to then serve as an aviation and strategic defense consultant. So, not much besides dates. And I don't want to kick off an investigation I can't control, because there's still so much more to investigate with this, but that is my little theory right now. If you guys have watched this and you have another theory, let me know what it is, because I really want to get to the bottom of this, because this is such an interesting story. And as we can see, that a 25-minute video takes over 40 minutes to kind of analyze, and not just watching the video, right? Like, you guys know I'm not just screen capping the video plan, me pausing it every couple of minutes and giving my thoughts. No, we're linking documents, we're linking cases, we're linking relevant video footage and clips. So yeah, that shows you how much meat is on the bone of this specific case. I think it's enthralling, and I really have tried to get in contact with the infographics team everything short of paying to become a member of theirs to join their Discord, which I just might at this point, because I really want to find this out. But I hope you guys had just as great of a time kind of sifting through this video as I did, and joining me on this venture as we try to learn more about this whistleblower and determine if this is a real individual and real experience. I know I find the biologics, the androids, one of the most interesting things ever since Grush came out last summer of 2023 and talked about biologics. That statement, as he testified to Congress, biologics, dead pilots, as he said to Ross Coulthart, has enthralled me. And hearing Gary Nolan talk about the hypothesis of biological androids, that's just something I found so interesting. If any of you guys listen to the podcast Mysterious Universe, I think this was back in 2017, I can't remember exactly when, they did a show on this exact subject, kind of like the classic Greys being a biological android. So for the better part of a decade now, I've been thinking about this theory. It's just been so interesting in my head. So, you know, watching this whistleblower say that these biologics are like children, respond to basic stimuli, keel over and dead and die when their purpose is done, it's just so fascinating to me. So in the comments, guys, let me know what you think. Please remember to like and subscribe. Always remember, I got a Patreon if you think the channel's worth anything. I don't gatekeep any content. Just support what you think the channel's worth. And please let me know what you think. I'd love to get some more discussion around this video, and I will catch everybody on the next show. Thank you.